program will start up again. So be looking for that if you're interested. But again, this is the last of our regular journey services in here, and again, we'll pick up once again in the fall. Let me make note of a couple things. Hopefully, did you guys see the table as you walked in out there in the mall area? There are a couple different resources on that that I just want to highlight real fast, and then I want to jump right into this here. A couple things. First of all, the video that you just watched, you saw Lee Strobel on there, I think highlighting things. It's a video. In fact, if we could go to slide two, you'll see a picture of that curriculum that we have. It's called Discussing the Da Vinci Code, Lee Strobel and Gary Poole. It's a really, really awesome four-week curriculum on this topic right here. If you have a small group and anyone's talking about it, I would really encourage you to take a look at this curriculum. It's one of the best that I've seen in a long time. It's done so well, really high quality. And Lee Strobel, who's an investigative journalist, has been for years, worked for the Chicago Tribune, actually goes over to some of these locations. And just like he does in his book, he actually interviews some scholars on this, and you get to see it, different from his books where you only get to read it. So great short four-week curriculum, and we have it here in our small groups library. So if you're in a small group, please feel free to check that out. Secondly, if you jump to slide three, I want to show you two resources, and we've got a couple of things for sale in the back there, and I just want to point these out to you because as over the past couple, well, actually a couple years, as I've been sort of reading over the Da Vinci Code responses to it, looking at it, there's practically a whole cottage industry starting up on books discussing the Da Vinci Code. And there's a plethora out there. There's a lot of them that are great. Two of them that I really like. And so we got a hold of 30 copies each of these. So if you want one, go pick it up. We're selling it for under the price. We're losing a little bit on each one. So you'll be hurting us with each one you buy. But that's okay. The Truth Behind the Da Vinci Code, Richard Abanis, he's a wonderful historian. He's also written a good amount just sort of on fiction. So he's a good person to, I think, critique it. And he does a neat job because his approach is different because he doesn't address just what exploring the Da Vinci Code by Lee Strobel does. Lee Strobel looks at kind of the historical Christian claims. Richard Abanis does a little bit broader of a picture. He just looks at claims from what about symbolism? What about the pentagram? What about these roses? What about the Priory of Sion? What about the Knights Templar? All these different components of just history in general he looks at. So that's a really good resource. The Truth Behind the Da Vinci Code is $6. The Lee Strobel book is only $4. Okay, so two good resources. Third thing that we're selling for just a quarter, again, still underpriced, is a resource. It's a 20-page full-color movie companion. Okay, if you're planning to go see the movie, if you know someone who's going to go see the movie, pick up one of those. It's just a quarter. Kind of walks through, here's the premise, here's what's going on. It's got pictures from the movie, and you know, even grab a couple of them if you'd like. And then the last thing you don't have to buy, it's free, is did you all get, along with your notes, a little handout there? That's a great, tiny pocketbook resource. I encourage you to make use of that. It very, very briefly walks through claim. Here's the historical reality. Fictional claim, historical reality. It just does it for a lot of different topics. So that's about the briefest, the most brief thing we have, and I kind of built up. So depending on how deep you want to get into this, they're all great resources. So I encourage you to check out that table there in the back if you would. Well, tonight what we're going to do is discuss the Da Vinci Code. I want to talk a little bit for about 45 minutes here. We're just going to talk about it. What are some of the claims made in it? But also, what should our response be? What should an appropriate Christian response look like? How should we think through these issues and then respond to it? Content and attitude. We'll look at that. And then for about another half hour, we've got two microphones set up here. If you guys have questions about this, we just want a dialogue. This is a time for us to just talk about, if it's methodology, hey, how do we address some of this stuff? And at the end, I'll talk a little bit about some ideas of ways that you can really practically engage in conversation with other people. Or if it's content questions, what about this? What about that? We'll have about a half hour to dialogue. So as we're talking, if a question comes to your mind, jot it down on a piece of paper. And then again, we'll spend about the last half hour just kind of dialoguing over it. So, well, if you notice, the sermon title this evening is Unriddling the Da Vinci Code, A Critical Exploration of Faith and History. Is that a boring title? I love those titles. Most people think they're boring. So, for those of you who think they're boring, I wanted to bring up the top 10 sermon titles we didn't choose. Okay? The top 10 sermon titles we didn't choose. Number 10. debunking Dan Brown's demonic, deliberate deception of the Da Vinci Code. Number 9, the Da Vinci Code, read the book, lose your soul, deal or no deal. Number 8, Dan Brown, the fifth horseman of Armageddon. Number 7, grab your picket signs and meet me at Cinemark. Number 6, why Dan Brown's favorite number is 666. Number 5, the road to hell is paved with the Da Vinci Code. Number 4, Dan Brown, Ron Howard, and Tom Hanks, the anti-Trinity. Number 3, the real Y2K. Number 2, how to pirate copies of the DVD when it comes out to keep Dan Brown from making money. And the number 1, top 10 sermon title we did not choose, we should have known going to movies was a sin. Well, that's about as close as I'll ever get to being on TV, so I just thought I would strive for it for a moment there. The reason I bring those up, you guys, is just to, for us to think a little bit about what is our reaction to this. It's been really interesting to look at the landscape of Christian thought, the church. How has the church responded? And I've seen some awesome responses, really, really neat ways of engaging. We'll talk a little bit about that. But I've also seen the opposite. I've seen this attempt to say, we're going to put up a bulwark, we're going to put up an absolute fence, and we're going to hold this off, and we're going to pick it, and we're going to be mad and angry about it. Now, again, was I angry? Yeah, I've been angry at different times about this. It's not to take away from it, but it's to say, what's the right response? Not reacting, but purposefully acting. How do we think through that? What do we do? How many of you guys have read the Da Vinci Code? Don't worry, you won't. You can keep your membership. How many of you? I've read it. How many of you have read the Da Vinci Code? Okay. It is an interesting read. Dan Brown is a very creative author. He does a wonderful job weaving together some really interesting historical facts along with some really interesting fiction. And that's an understatement in some senses. But he's a wonderful author. He does a very good job. It's an interesting read. I would encourage you to pick it up. Go on Amazon, buy it used if you don't want to put any money into his pocket. But it's an interesting read. Engage with it, you guys. If we are not familiar with what our world is thinking, the issues are thinking about, what's the word? Irrelevant. Do we want to be relevant? Yeah. I remember hearing someone say, irrelevance is irreverence. Because God is relevant. So we have to be too. And that's reverencing God. Because God calls me to be a change agent in my world. Not by hiding in my closet, but by coming out and actively, winsomely engaging our world. Well, why are we addressing this? We're addressing it because it's an issue. A George Barna, who is a public opinion pollster, surveyed a number of people who had read it. 53% of Americans who had read it, who were surveyed, 53%, a little over half, said this as a result. They found the book, quote, helpful in their personal spiritual growth and understanding. Meaning, it's having a spiritual impact. Reason enough. That's why we're addressing it, right? Because people are saying, this is interesting. Let's talk about this. And some people are saying, this has really impacted and changed the way that I look at spirituality, reality, the world. So the big question is this. Do we protest, boycott, or engage? We could do any one of those. And it's not to say that it's never appropriate to do the first two. But I think in this case, I want us to engage the world for the reasons that I just stated earlier. You know, when I first read this, I mean, at a gut level, I was kind of mad. I mean, I'm loving the book, and I get to about 232, and blah, there it is. And I'm just thinking, what? What? And I keep reading it for about 20 pages. From about 230 to 250 is where you get it all. That's where it all comes. And a little bit later, up until that point, it's a great story. And then, you know, I start getting mad, and I start thinking about what's going on. This isn't true. So gut reaction, yeah, I'm angry. But again, I've got to think about, okay, how does God want me to react? Can God possibly use this as some way of actually furthering the kingdom? Remember the words of Joseph about what some actions of people who were really doing some evil things. He said, what you have intended for evil, God has intended for good. And I think we can have this exact same response here. God can intend this for an awesome thing. So we've been thrown a boulder. We can either get mad about it, try to kick it back, or we can jump up on top of it and say, this is a platform for me to talk about in a kind, gentle way the true person of Jesus, the first century Jesus. Because think about this, you guys. When was the last time that our secular culture was actually asking questions about the historical person of Jesus. I love the movie The Passion. They weren't asking questions about the historical person of Jesus, though, were they? This is the first time in decades. So our response is critical. It is huge. So we have got to get equipped. Listen to some words by Ben Witherington. He's an historian. He writes, "It is not surprising that a powerful and well-written thriller," referring to the Da Vinci Code, "could have had such an impact," listen to this, how he describes us, "in an age of widespread biblical illiteracy and of ignorance of early Christian history." Because this is why I'm excited. You know why? Because it's forcing me, it's forcing you to get up off my seat and say, I need to actually study. I need to do some work. I need to go into the woodshed and think. I need to know the history of God's people, God's church. How many of us know much about the different things that went on in the first three centuries? I don't think many of us do. So this is a great wake-up call. I'm so glad, in a sense, that this has come. I welcome it in that sense. So here's why we're addressing this. Now, the book on the front cover very clearly says a novel. Right? We need to remind ourselves that as we're reading, it's just a novel. It's just a novel, right? There's no place like home. There's no place. It's just a novel, okay, as we go. But here's where it gets confusing. On the opening flap of the first page, the author tells us these words, among a few other things. He says, fact. He's going to tell us, what I'm going to tell you in this novel, though, is factual. And here's where things get a little confusing for us, the readers. He writes, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. Okay? So this is where I think people start getting tripped up thinking it's an historical novel, but the background, sure, the dialogue and the people are fictional, but the background is accurate. It's historical. And that's where we're going to dialogue a little bit tonight about. And again, people are taking this as factual. It's not enough to just say it's a novel, everyone knows it. Listen to the president of Doubleday Publishers. This is the president of the publishing company that published Dan Brown's book. Quote, John Grisham teaches you about torts. Tom Clancy teaches you about military technology. Dan Brown gives you a crash course in art history and the Catholic Church. Many people are assuming this is factual history. This is why we're responding. Does that make sense? If for no other reason, please don't have the view of just saying, who cares, it's just a novel. People care. And if you care about people, I hope you will care too. That's why I do. So let's get right into this here, for the sake of time. Responding to the claims of the Da Vinci Code, and again, we'll go for a little while here, another half hour, and hopefully get through all this, and then we'll just have some time with Q&A. Here's the first point that I want to look at. Number one on your handout, Rome numeral one, no one regarded Jesus as divine until the 4th century. What he's referring to there, if you've read the book, is that the Emperor Constantine was responsible for sort of upgrading Jesus' status. Listen to some of the words in the book that come to us on page 234. At this gathering, now the character is talking about this council in 325, what's called the Council of Nicaea. At this gathering, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon. The date of Easter, the role of the bishops, the administration of sacraments, and, of course, the divinity of Jesus. And the young lady who the scholar is talking to says, wait, voted on the divinity of Jesus? And he responds, my dear, up until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. He goes on to say, Jesus' establishment as, quote, the Son of God, was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. Hold on, Sophie says. You're saying Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? A relatively close vote at that, he answered. Nonetheless, establishing Christ's divinity was critical to the further unification of the Roman Empire and to the new Vatican power base. By officially endorsing Jesus as the Son of God, Constantine, okay, this Roman emperor, turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallengeable. It was all about power. Christ as Messiah was critical to the functioning of the church and state. Many scholars claim that the early church literally stole Jesus from his original followers, hijacking his human message, shrouding it in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using it to expand their own power. Okay? So do you understand the claim that is being made here? The claim is that the real Jesus was just everyday Joe Jesus. He was a guy who had some really good ethical teachings. But he never claimed to be divine. In fact, all of his friends, his followers, never said he was divine. I mean, we're talking, Dan Brown says, it was in the 4th century that people started to say, maybe this guy was God. Let's say as though he was. In fact, if we do it, it'll help us have sort of an official state religion. Rome will be strong. It was a power move. Well, here's what I want to look at. Is that true? Let's look at some historical evidence. Letter A, the Council of Nicaea. What went on there? Council of Nicaea in 325. There are two people involved in this debate going on. There was a Council of Nicaea. It did take place in 325. And the two primary people who were sort of standing up on stage, so to speak, and debating. Now, there are 300 pastors at this. 300 pastors from around the Mediterranean world, different locations, all come together. Many of them come, we're told by church historians, with scars on their face because they've lived through the persecution. And in 311, Constantine, he hasn't made it the state religion at all yet. He's just said, we'll tolerate you. So many of these Christians are coming there, scars, eyes gouged out. And these pastors are coming from around the Mediterranean world to discuss a debate about the divinity of Jesus. But here's the twist. The guy who was eventually condemned as a heretic, okay, an apostate, someone who wasn't holding to what Jesus taught, was named Arius. And you see him there on your outline. The other guy, Athanasius, who was arguing, saying, no, Jesus was divine. Again, I'll talk a little bit about what exactly the nuances are there. He said something very different. Now, the two Greek words that they were battling back and forth on, in fact, we have a common phrase that we use all the time. Probably many of us have used it and never realized it came from the Council of Nicaea. Athanasius said, Jesus is homoousia. Homo meaning same, ousia meaning substance. Arius said, no, he's homoi, similar, ousia, substance. We have the phrase today. Does anyone know what it is? It doesn't matter one iota. Have you heard that before? It doesn't matter one iota what you think. An iota is that little letter that looks like an I in the Greek alphabet. Being an understatement, because it mattered a great deal, one iota. You add one iota, one letter I, to the word, and you're changing from Jesus from being the same substance of God to Jesus being a similar substance of God. This is the debate. This is the entire debate there. Now, here's the problem. Guess what Arius believed? That Jesus was divine. But he believed he became divine. It's almost our concept, if you've had much contact with the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, also known as the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's the idea that Jesus became God at a certain point. It's sort of an honorary title that was conferred upon him. Okay? So think about this. Even the quote-unquote heretics believed Jesus was divine. No one was debating whether or not he was divine. They were debating, was he eternally divine, co-existent with the Father, or did he become divine at some point? Was he adopted? Okay? So this is the debate. There is no debate on whether or not Jesus is divine. The heretics believe he was divine. But it still matters, was he eternally or not? So there's one problem right there. Secondly, he says it was a close vote over his divinity. Guess how many bishops were there? A little over 300. Somewhere between 305, 319 bishops there. And each one of those bishops also had two sort of underlings with them, elders or deacons of some sort. So the 300 pastors or bishops, same word, voted. Guess what the vote was? 300-2. That's the close vote that Dan Brown talks about. And it wasn't even over, was he divine? It was, in what sense is he divine? So right there, we've got a huge problem from what history tells us. In fact, we even know Athanasius and Sadducus are the two men who voted in favor of Jesus being homoousia. We have all the records, all the documentation. Pick up any history book, you guys, from that period. It doesn't matter what perspective, Christian or secular, you're going to find this out. This is not hidden information. Letter B, looking at was Jesus really concocted as a divine being in the 4th century. We have also what's called the Apostolic Fathers. Now, that's kind of a weird-sounding phrase, right? And what's called the Anti-Nicene Fathers. All it means is the people who preceded or who followed the apostles. I don't know why they call them Apostolic Fathers. They should be called Apostolic Sons. But for some reason, we call them Apostolic Fathers. These are the people who were, for instance, Polycarp. Polycarp is a guy who was a disciple of John, who wrote the Gospel of John, one of Jesus's 12 disciples. The people who came immediately after the apostles, who received the baton of the apostles and began running with doing church in God's world. The apostolic fathers, if you look across the panoply of these writings, and there's tons, you guys. I've got some footnotes in here giving you examples. If you want to look up a book with all the writings of these apostolic fathers, their volumes and volumes, you can find it. They're all saying the same thing. Jesus is divine. Let me give you one example. Irenaeus. This is written, or he lived 115 to 190. Irenaeus did. Okay, this is an early church father right after the first century. Okay, so he's living in the 100s. He has a writing called Against Heresies. All right, there, if you remember, Dan Brown said the word heresy was concocted at the Council of Nicaea. Another inaccuracy. In Irenaeus writes, in order that through Christ Jesus, our Lord and God and Savior and King, according to the will of the invisible Father, and then he quotes the Bible, every knee should bow, every tongue confess. We have the early church fathers saying the exact same thing that the Bible said about the deity of Christ. Go through it. Justin the Martyr, Ignatius, all these other guys, you'll find the exact same things in their writings as well. Long before Constantine, people thought Jesus was God. Now, was he really? Well, that's another issue. But people, his followers, really thought he was God long before Constantine came on the scene. Letter C, another example. The New Testament Gospels. Now, this might at first, you might think, well, that's a weak argument. We're talking about the reliability of the Bible. Sure, I recognize that. But no one debates that what we have in the first four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are the earliest writings of the Christian church. No one debates that. We'll talk a little bit tonight about the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary. Everyone recognizes those came afterwards. Everyone recognizes the four Gospels came first. All scholars, even the most liberal scholar you can find, is going to agree with that. And of course, it doesn't take very long to look. Mark, which is written first, then Luke, then Matthew, John, these are all clearly stating Jesus is divine. He's the Son of God. He's deity. Whether they're right or not, again, different issue, but they all certainly believe it. Letter D. This is interesting. This is one of the great ironies of the book that I found when I first read it. Gnostic Gospels. Now, how many of you guys have heard about Gnostic Gospels? It's said like Gnostic, but it's not said like that. Gnostic. Gnosticism refers to a very broad movement. It wasn't one group. They weren't all sort of buddies. It's sort of a broad way to scoop up a lot of different people in the second century primarily into a group who believed a certain thing. Gnosticism basically said this. A long, long time ago, there was this one divine God, who is sort of the all-in-all. And this divine God is pure spirit, and he created lesser gods. Sort of like almost picture the sun and like emanations out of the sun, if you can imagine that sort of a chart. And these lesser gods became, in a sense, lesser of God. And eventually we got to one God who is either wicked or foolish or something along those lines, and decides that he's going to do something which the original God would just view as horrible, and that is create matter. Because see, the Gnostic view, all Gnostics held this. This is a simplification, but if you want to write something down and know something about Gnosticism, spirit is good, matter is evil. That's a very crude form of it, but that's it. Spirit's good, matter is evil. Physical stuff it's not just lesser, it's actually evil. It's the result of being evil. And so what we find is that the Gnostic Gospels, when they talked about, basically here's their view. Let me kind of finish the story. Their view is that things are wrong. What's wrong? Well, my soul, which is spirit, is imprisoned in my body, right? My soul, good, is imprisoned in my body, evil. So what happens is another one of these gods, these emanations, what's called these demiurges, these lesser gods, who's higher than the one that created, Sophia, and if you recognize that name from the book, Sophia, which is the Greek word for wisdom, comes down and liberates us from this world, is a savior in a sense. Not saving from sin, but saving from ignorance. Okay, the problem is gnosis, Gnosticism. Gnosis meaning knowledge. That's the problem. It's not a moral, sinful problem. You don't need to be reunited relationally with God because you're in rebellion. It's that you just don't know enough. So education is the solution. But it's not even for everyone, it's only for the elite, the highly intellectual. Here's the problem, you guys. Gnosticism viewed that the body was evil, the spirit is good. Guess which one Jesus is? Now, remember, Gnostics thought Jesus was God. Which one is he, physical or spiritual? He can't be physical because that's evil. So guess how they viewed Jesus. This sort of hallucination, this ghost living his life. This is why many Gnostics did not like the concept of the crucifixion. Spirit can't die, body can die. So either Gnostics said, well, then his divine being separated from his body before the crucifixion, or he just seemed to suffer, you know, he seemed to be thirsty, he seemed to be hungry, all the different things we read about in the Gospels. But he couldn't have really, because that means he was physical. Physical is evil. So this is the Gnostic understanding of Jesus. So the great irony here is Gnostics, virtually all of them, thought Jesus was God. Guess what they didn't think he was? Human. Most Gnostics debated that Jesus was human, and they said, no way, baloney, because matter is evil. And Jesus is the Sophia. He is that which is coming to liberate us, again, not dying for our sins, but giving us new revelation. That's why all the Gnostic Gospels, it's always Jesus taking one person off alone and whispering secret revelation in their ear, because it's all about knowledge. Different from the New Testament Gospels, remember where Jesus is accused of teaching things, and he says, what are you accusing me for? Everything I've ever taught has been in public. So he didn't seem to teach, according to the New Testament Gospels, secret knowledge. It was knowledge for all. It was public knowledge. Interestingly, if you want to look up 1 John 4:1, John is actually coming in contact. John's probably a little bit later in the first century. He's coming in contact with sort of a prototype of Gnosticism. If you remember in this passage, he says, test the spirits. Guess what the test is? Do they teach that Jesus came in the flesh? Fully God, fully man. That's the test, he was saying. So he's beginning to deal, it seems like, with early forms of Gnosticism. Although Gnosticism in its full-blown form wasn't around till the 200s, the second century. Or the 100s, excuse me, the second century. So did Christians, did the early followers of Jesus view him as divine? Absolutely. We have no evidence that they did. Even the enemies thought he was divine, by meaning in-house enemies of the Gnostics. Well, how about this one? Letter E, secular sources. Okay, because we're looking at forms of Christianity, even Gnostic Christianity. How about secular sources? Pliny the Younger. Now, Pliny the Younger is writing from 62 AD to 113. Okay, this is very soon after the death, crucifixion, the burial of Jesus. Pliny the Younger writes a letter to Trajan. Now, Pliny does not like Christians, which is always interesting to hear the other side's view. And he writes this. He says, he's talking about how Christians are being persecuted. And he says, these Christians, all they're saying that they're guilty of is basically being good people. And as you see what's underlined there, what they do is they meet on a certain fixed day at sunrise, that being the first day of the week, as we read in the Gospel, and reciting an antiphonal hymn to Christ as God. Meaning, even the enemies recognize these goofball Christians believe this dead man is God. And how ridiculous is that? To show you another example of how ridiculous they thought it was, look at the next point here. Alexamenos graffiti. The Alexamenos graffiti is a popular ridicule that is discovered in a guardroom on Palatine Hill near the Circus Maximus. And as you see up on the screen there, this is a picture of a man who has the head of a donkey, to put it nicely. And there is a man standing nearby, arms stretched out in adoration. And the sort of slanderous statement that is written on the wall there is, Alexamenos worships his God. Christians were mocked for worshiping a dead Savior. How foolish is that, right? The guy's dead. Rome won. He's not your Savior. Okay, the point being, did the early Christians think Jesus was divine? Yeah. Even their enemies recognize it. There's absolutely no debate on it. Okay, next point. Roman numeral 2. There are earlier, unaltered Gospels which lost out due to church politics. This is to say, you know, there were actually like 80 Gospels, Dan Brown claims, that Constantine in 325 sort of weeded out the ones which spoke of him as being human. We don't want to talk about him human. We want a divine Jesus. And they found the ones that really talked about his divinity, and then he even dressed him up more. He said, let's paint the picture even bigger about this guy being divine, because remember, then he's unchallengeable. He can't challenge this divine Savior who lives beyond this world. Here are some points. Are there other Gospels? First, letter A, the New Testament recognizes the existence of other accounts of Jesus' life. If you look there, Luke 1, 1 through 3, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the Word. Okay, so right there he's saying, you know what, many people have drawn up an account of Jesus' life. Luke certainly recognizes other, if we want to call them Gospels, some had the title, some didn't, accounts of what either, sometimes just what he said or what he did. A popular way to write back then was, you know, today if we like what people do, we, put it together and, you know, the best of and make a CD. Back then they did something like that. They wrote, these are sort of the best of their statements. There's no narrative, there's no story, it's just a bunch of different statements, things along those lines. The Gospel of Thomas is just a bunch of statements, 114 actually, statements about that. Galatians 1:6. Take a look at this with me. Galatians 1:6. This is the Apostle Paul, and he writes, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and turning to, look, a different gospel. Now, he's not talking about necessarily a written gospel, but he's talking about a totally different picture of who Jesus is. And then he kind of does a play on words, he says, which is really no gospel at all, because, of course, the word gospel means good news. You're turning to another good news, which really is not good news. It's bad news. Why? Because it cannot connect you with God. So the New Testament authors recognize there are other perspectives on Jesus, right? I mean, my goodness, the Pharisees' perspective on him was what? Demon-possessed, right? If you remember from the first Gospel of Mark, I think chapter 3. Letter B. Even many Gnostics recognize the New Testament Gospels as authoritative. Now, this is interesting. I got a question for you. Guess who made the first list of acceptable books to go into the Bible? Because Dan Brown tells us, you know, it's the church who said, okay, here's what's acceptable and here's what's not. We're going to weed out the ones we don't like. Guess who made the first list weeding other ones out? It was a Gnostic teacher named Marcion. And he's listed right in your handout there. Marcion was a Gnostic teacher. He was excommunicated by the church, kicked out in 144. His Bible consisted of Luke, not all of it. He didn't like some of the first part. He basically didn't like anything that had to do with Judaism. He thought the God of the Old Testament was a different, mean God. The God of the New Testament, Jesus, is a nice, kind God. So anything that was Jewish, smacked of Judaism, he just cut it out. So he didn't like the first part of Luke. He liked all the rest. He liked 10 of Paul's writings. He didn't like the rest because they, again, smacked too much of Judaism. The first Bible, the first person who's really going through and saying, we shouldn't accept this, we should accept this, is a Gnostic teacher, not the church. Now, in response to this, the church says, we better talk about this because this guy's starting to say these books that we all accept are not authoritative. They're not the word we use as canon, authority, standard, ruler. And guess which book Marcion the Gnostic did not include? Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Mary. Your choice. The only one he liked was the Gospel of Luke. Now that's telling. Now, that doesn't mean all Gnostics didn't like those, but we have Gnostics who say the canonical Gospels, especially Luke in his case, this is accurate. This is the picture, real picture of Jesus. Letter C. The church debated the acceptance of 7 of the 27 books, now including the New Testament. Guess which books they never debated? It was never up for debate in a church council or anything else. The first 4, among others. I mean, there are others as well. All 20. In fact, of the 27, but 4 of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as well as Acts, no question, no debate. Meaning the church universal, think about this, living different parts of the Mediterranean world, they're not emailing each other back and forth. Okay, they're not sending faxes. They're not calling one another on the phone. They're doing church independently, and all of them are recognizing independently Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as accurate pictures of the first century person of Jesus. Interesting. Doesn't seem to be Constantine cutting out, 76 Gospels and keeping 4, does it? Doesn't sound like that. There's no record of any argument being made for the inclusion of other Gospels in the New Testament. Now, there may have been. We've lost a lot of information, but we don't have any record of it, so there's no reason necessarily to believe that. And as you see a list, there are 4 different canons that we have, meaning someone actually writing down and saying, okay, here's the canon, here's what's authoritative, here's what's not. The first four that we have, the first one, the Muratorian canon, comes to us right at the end of the second century, 190, and included all of them. Origen's Bible, Eusebius's Bible, the one that was finally fixed at the Council of Carthage, they all have them. They all have the four Gospels. And there's no debate that they were even considering other ones. There's just no record of it. Maybe they did. We simply have no record of it. Again, not exactly what we're told. The four canonical Gospels were always included in any suggestion of list of books. Okay, let's jump to Rome numeral 3 here. We're going fast, I know. The church suppressed Jesus' marriage to Mary Magdalene. Now, maybe some of you are saying, ooh, this is where it's getting yummy. This is where it's getting good. Was Jesus married, and was it Mary Magdalene? Did he have a child, as the book claims? Her name was Sarah. Is there any information of that? Do we have reason to believe that? First question I want to ask is something that I think we Christians need to ask ourselves. I was just talking to someone in the office about this the other day. They were telling me that they went for a walk with their dog with a neighbor and saying, man, I didn't know Jesus was, you know, God. You know, what do you think about that? Do you think it's possible? And she said, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's a question we need to ask. Is there a problem? Now, had Jesus been married? I don't think he was. But had he been married, is there a big theological problem with that? As long as he kept sex within the bounds of marriage. No. There is no problem with that. Now, why is that significant? Because Dan Brown claims that the early church was trying to kind of erase this aspect of his life. Why? Because it made him look human, right? And we just wanted the divine God. And so we were trying to get rid of this, because if he was married, then he's human. But apparently we forgot to take out that he had a pretty sad birth, and that he was hungry, and that he was tired, and eventually, the worst part of mortality, he died. Those are bigger signs of mortality or being human than being married. So Brown's almost assuming that marriage is bad. Early Christian church never thought that. Never thought that marriage was bad. So no, there's not a problem to it. Letter B, did all Jewish males have to be married? Brown also makes the argument, says it would have been unheard of almost. Had a Jewish man not been married, it was like a mandate, a command. You better be married. If you're a Jewish man, you got to do it. Especially if you're going to be a teacher or anyone of prominence in the world. Is that true? Let me read some words to you by someone who does not believe Jesus was God, does not believe Jesus rose from the dead. His name is John Dominic Crossan. He's one of the co-founders of what's called the Jesus Seminar. Now, this guy, again, has no interest in Jesus being God. He's sure he is not. But this is his response in an article entitled, Why Jesus Didn't Marry. He writes this, there's an ancient and venerable principle about biblical interpretation which states that if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it must be a camel in disguise. So let's apply that to whether or not Jesus was married. There is no evidence that Jesus was married. Looks like a duck. Multiple indications that he was not. Walks like a duck. No early text suggesting wife or children. Quacks like a duck. So he must have been an incognito bridegroom. Camel in disguise. Now, this guy just dismisses it. It's ridiculous. Of course he wasn't married. Doesn't really even deal with it. And again, this guy has no interest in Jesus' divinity. He doesn't think he's divine. John Dominic Crossan does not hold to a divine Jesus. He thinks he's just a guy. But he says, historically, we have no reason to believe he was married. Better reason to believe he was single. Here's some of that information. Let me give you three different Jewish groups who all held to some form of celibacy. There's what's called the Qumran community. Have you heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls before? Right? The Dead Sea, in fact, if we've got if you can find that slide there on the Dead Sea, I think it's slide 6. The Dead Sea Scrolls is a group of writings that was discovered at the Qumran community. It's at the northwest part of the Dead Sea. And probably the group was destroyed when Rome comes through and wipes them out, when they destroy Masada, which is a little bit south of there. But what was discovered is in 1947, Dan Brown says in the 50s, but it's actually 1947, there were 11 caves that were investigated, and these scrolls were taken out. Now, Dan Brown says they have a lot to do with early Christianity. Problem is they all predate Christianity, so they don't say a lick about Christianity. Nevertheless, these different scrolls that were found there talked about a lot of different things. Every single book of the Old Testament except Esther was included there. There's a bronze kind of almost an Indiana Jones treasure map that was found out in the Judean wilderness, talks about a buried treasure out there, lots of different things, as well as rules and practices for who should we excommunicate, who should we accept in the community, the kind of ritual washings we should do, on and on. Guess what? The Essenes, now we believe those are the people who lived there, we're not sure, pretty sure, the Essenes practiced celibacy. It was an all-male group practicing celibacy. So the Qumran community does that. Now the Essenes, who were located also in other parts of the world, not Qumran community Essenes, different group also practicing celibacy. Finally, there's called the Therapeutai. This is a group of men and women. They're located in Egypt. And this group, Philo, first and second century historian, writes about this group here. They all promoted celibacy as a spiritual ideal, meaning you have wholehearted devotion and focus toward God. And therefore, you put off other things. You don't get married. Okay? So, were all Jewish men mandated to be married? No, clearly not. Here are three groups. And likewise, we can look at other ones as well, other people, whether it be John the Baptist, other Old Testament prophets who forewent marriage. Even consider this. What evidence is there concerning Jesus' marital status? Okay? We looked at the possibility that he wasn't married, but what actual information do we have? Well, let me give you the Gospel of Philip. Okay, this is where Dan Brown really digs his information. If you've read the book, he goes to the Gospel of Philip. Lee Teabing, as he's sitting in his study having a conversation with Sophie Naveau, says, I just happen to have my Gospel of Philip book on my table here. He pulls it up and he says, this is a good place to start. No, the Gospel of Thomas probably would have been a little bit better. It's more respected by scholars. But he says, let me read for you a section here. And if you want to go to slide 30, he reads this section, but he reads it quite differently than what it's actually in. And the companion of the Lord was Mary Magdalene. He loved her more than all the other disciples, and he used to kiss her often on the lips. Now, if you see a problem, you're awake. The problem is, do you see all the sections in red? Those are the sections that have been eaten away on the scroll, and we don't know what they say. So what we read is this, and the companion of the Mary Magdalene, her more than the disciples, kiss her on her. That's all we've got. Now there is another parallel passage in the Gospel of Philip which refers to Jesus kissing Mary on the lips. What does this mean? Well, 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about the holy kiss, the kiss of greeting. If you've been many places, I've read about in the Soviet Union, before the fall of the curtain, I had a professor who went over there, and he came back and was horrified because these elderly men didn't yet know that Americans were freaked out when these old men would grab younger men and right on the lips. There was nothing erotic, I guarantee you, about these elderly Soviet Union men kissing Americans on the lips. Nothing erotic about it. It was culturally acceptable. It was something that was done as a way of saying hello. If you remember in one ending that Paul ends in one of his letters, he says, greet one another with a holy kiss. Right? We've all had plenty of jokes and fun with that, right? Greet one another with a holy kiss. So I think it's very plausible that this text did say Jesus kissed Mary Magdalene on the lips. It likely did. It possibly did. Maybe it didn't. But if it did, there's still no problem with it. This was a regular cultural practice that was done. Men to men, men to women, women to women. It was a cultural thing that was acceptable. It was not considered erotic. So that doesn't seem to carry water. Consider this too, 2 Corinthians 9. This is an interesting argument about was Jesus married or not. Now this is Paul writing, and listen to his argument. We have to kind of read between the lines and look at what he didn't say. This is my defense to those who sit in judgment on me. He's writing to people saying, I have the right to be supported. I don't have to work a second job. I can do missionary work and actually receive money from churches. Okay, this is what he's arguing for. But you're sitting in judgment, he's saying, hey, go get a job, you lazy bum. Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us? As do the other apostles and the Lord's brother and Cephas, Cephas being Peter. Now, what would have really clinched his argument is if he would have mentioned who? Jesus. The strongest argument that Paul could have made for, I have the right to have a believing wife. I mean, look at Jesus. He had one. But he appeals to the highest level he can. Look at the apostles. Even the Lord's brother was that James. You know, we know that Jesus had four brothers. Who knows which one he was talking about? Possibly James. Who knows? But he didn't mention what would have clinched his argument. Now, that's an argument from silence. I realize that. But some arguments from silence are better than others. I think that one's pretty good. Matthew 19:10. Take a look at another example, especially was it unheard of for a man to be single? Matthew 19:10. Jesus talks a little bit about this issue of people who are eunuchs. He says some people were made eunuchs, meaning forced to be. Other people have chose it for the purpose of serving God more fully, having a full devotion. Now, if none of his Jewish followers were like that, who do you suppose he might have been talking about? Especially the fact that he's glorifying singleness. And he says it's a gift. It's not for everyone. It's for those who can receive it. It's not the norm, but it's a gift from God, he calls it. So Jesus seemed to think singleness was okay. All of you who are single said, oh, thank goodness, you were worried. There's nothing wrong with marriage, but Jesus had a unique mission. He came from a long line of prophets who had made vows, consecrated themselves to God. Again, John the Baptist is another example of that. Here's one more argument. Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, this is interesting. A couple points here. If you remember back to the cross, who was there? We read of different people being there. Certainly we read of women being there. Mary, the mother of Jesus. We also read Mary Magdalene was there. And some other women as well, other Marys. Guess which woman Jesus, in his last moments, in hideous torture and pain, his back lacerated, rubbing up and down on this wooden cross, in his flesh hanging like ribbons, he thinks of one last person that he wants taken care of after he's dead. Who is it? It wasn't Mary Magdalene. She was there. That would have been appropriate had that been his wife. He would have fulfilled what is right as a Jewish man, but he did fulfill what was right as a Jewish man. He took care of his mother. John, apparently his closest friend, would you watch over her? Another kind of interesting piece of information that probably his other brothers weren't believers at the point. Now we read later James became a believer. Number two, think about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and think about the Roman Catholic view of Mary. Okay, for just a second. How many of you grew up Roman Catholic? Okay, there's a great veneration for the Virgin Mary, is there not? Does that jive with the statement that the Roman Catholic Church was trying to put down women? No, I don't think so at all. Now, I say this as a Protestant, that I think that this, you know, desire to almost have a quasi-divine female counterpart to God was what was compelling some portion of the early church to say Mary was, you know, the mother of God. They talked about things along those lines. So we don't see any evidence that the church was trying to suppress women. If anything, I think they went too far. And they actually found this woman, the mother of Jesus, and lifted her up. Now, think about who would have been a better person for that. If he had a wife, it would have been her, right? That would have been a lot better candidate to say, this is almost a quasi-divine being. But early church didn't do that. Interesting. Last point here. Did the early church suppress women's role in the church? Letter A, Jesus' inclusion of women in the New Testament. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. This is not a big deal to us. We read over it because we're 21st century Americans. Okay, there's a great amount of equality and egalitarianism among men and women in our day. This is not the case in first century Palestine. Women are considered second-class citizens at best. But look at how Jesus treats them. He has women disciples. Other rabbis didn't do that. That's odd. Jesus talked with a Samaritan woman in private. Other men, especially other teachers, religious leaders, didn't do that. This is countercultural. Who were the first witnesses of the empty tomb? Women. Now, think about this for a second. A woman's word, in a legal sense, was worth zip first century world in a Jewish context. Had there been a theft, and I'm accused of being a thief, and I have 10 women up on stage, and I'm in a court of law, and all 10 women say, he did it, we saw him, guess what? I get off. They're women. Their word is worth nothing. So why would the early church talk about, and why did Jesus allow, for crying out loud, women? That's not a good argument. That's a horrible argument. Unless the gospel authors recorded something that was an embarrassment to them, but they recorded it accurately because they thought truth mattered. because they thought lying was wrong. It's interesting. So Jesus elevated the view of women. Take a look for a second. The Gnostic view of women. Again, I've said numerous times, the most ironic thing to me about the whole book is that Dan Brown chose Gnosticism. Guess how Gnostics view women? I'm going to give you the best case scenario and the worst case scenario. Best case scenario, Gospel of Philip. This is as good as it gets for you ladies if you're a Gnostic. Okay? This is as good as it gets. Gospel of Philip 68:22-26, as well as another reference there. The original intent for humanity is said to be an androgynous being. And remember, what's evil with the Gnosticism? Matter, physical, you know, the physical reality. Sex, sexuality is considered an evil thing. Because you're allowing your physical impulses to control you. Right? And so there's sort of an asceticism. Nope, I'm not going to engage it. So sexuality is considered wrong. In the Gospel of Philip, guess who the only two good people are? Free men. They're very, very down on slaves. Slaves are horrible. They're sort of lesser beings. Free men and virgin women. Those are the only two sort of high-class beings who can get the secret revelation and all this stuff. So at best, all you ladies, you had better be a virgin or else you are low end of the totem pole within a Gnostic worldview. Now, at worst, Gospel of Thomas. If you go to slide 32, listen to how the last statement, I told you there are 114 statements in the Gospel of Thomas. Listen to how the Gospel of Thomas ends. I'm sure you ladies will give a hearty amen after reading this. Simon Peter said to them, he's talking to the other apostles and to Jesus. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." So within a Gnostic worldview, ladies, what's your position? It's not very good. At best, it's lose your sexuality and become androgynous. That's what Adam and Eve really were. Originally, it was this androgynous being, and they split, and that's wrong, so we've got to get them back together. Not through sexuality, because that's evil. And at worst case, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you'll get to be a man like me in the resurrection, and so you can have eternity, and all the women said. Some of you, amen. Just sheep, mere sheep. The sacred feminine. Dan Brown, refers to women, the sacred feminine. They were honored, they were worshipped. You guys, what's the position of women within Gnosticism? It's not that great. You're a lot better off in the four Gospels. As a disciple of Jesus, as someone he will talk to, as someone he will allow to touch him, and someone who he will allow to be the first witnesses to his male apostles of the resurrected Jesus. Wow. That's a high position of women, a high view of women. Last point, the real secret, Roman numeral 5. Guess what the real code is? There is a code in the Bible. There is a secret. And it's something that for generations and generations people looked into, they tried to figure it out, they tried to solve it, and they couldn't. Angelic beings looked into it. They couldn't solve it. Satan himself looked into it. He could not solve it. 1 Peter 1, 10 through 12 tells us what the code is. 1 Peter 1, 10. "Concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently and with greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, when they spoke of," quote, look at this, "things that had been, that had now been told you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, even angels long to look into these things." Even angels for years and years until the coming of Christ longed to look into what was God's plan. There was a code. Now, the first clue was not at the Louvre Museum. It was in Genesis chapter 3. The first clue is, Eve, a woman, your seed will bruise the head of the serpent. Why is that important? Because Genesis 3, we have the fall of humanity out of relationship with God. They're in rebellion. And their sentence is death, separation from God. And God gives the first clue of a solution. It's a code. Your seed will make all things right, and it's going to be a human being. Okay, it's very vague. That's not a very great clue. It's a human being who's going to set things straight. Well, then to Abraham, God says, your seed will be a blessing to the entire world. So now it's not just a human being. It's one particular person of the Semitic people, Abraham, who his descendants, of course, become the Jews. Then he says, even beyond that, Isaac, your seed. Jacob, your seed. So it's not going to be any of their brothers. Finally, David. He makes a covenant with David. It will be your seed that will sit on the throne forever. A king will come in your line. Human, Semitic people. There's still 12 tribes of the tribe of Judah. Not only the tribe of Judah, the family of David, who it will be. And as we go, we get more and more clues to the code. He'll be born in Bethlehem, would have to flee to Egypt, have a Galilean ministry, rejected by his own people, betrayed by a friend, sold for 30 pieces of silver, silent to accusations, spat upon and smitten, crucified with sinners, hands pierced, given vinegar and gall, soldiers gambled for his coat, no bones broken, side pierced, buried with the rich, rise from the dead, would ascend to the right hand of God. And we begin to ask, as our first mother Eve did, who will walk through this door? The door starts out really broad. It's a human person. It's a descendant of Abraham, of the Semitic people. It's in the tribe of Judah. And pretty soon, the door doesn't stay a door. It turns into a lock. And the only thing that can walk through that lock is a key. It's very specific. Who can do it? Do you know which title the gospel writers record Jesus using for himself more than any other? Son of Man. It's the one title that Jesus chooses for himself above all other titles, Son of Man. Let me read you a passage in which he said this, and I think to his readers identifies, I'm the key to the lock. Mark 14:61. He is standing before Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Immediately, the high priest tears his clothes. Why? Because he didn't just say, I'm a man, the Son of Man. The Son of Man had specific overtones. What kind of overtones did it have? Well, to Joseph Caiaphas, who was steeped in the Old Testament, he immediately, in his mind, would have gone to passages like Daniel 7, because this is where we have the concept of Son of Man. Listen to this. Daniel 7:13-14. This is Daniel speaking. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man. So he's a human. That's all we're reading about so far. Broad door. Coming with the clouds of heaven. This is the picture of ascending to heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, all nations, and men of every language worshipped him. Huh. Now, it's also taught in the Bible, you only worship God. Door's getting smaller. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. An eternal being that people worship? Who could this be? Jesus, the first century person of Jesus, thought it was himself. And he gave a lot of signs and pieces of evidence that it was him. He said the most significant sign he would give was that he would lay down his life. Not only that, because a lot of people can do that, but then actually take it back up. The fact of the resurrection, a historical fact. Something that as we look at history, we need not be afraid of historical claims. We need not be afraid even of claims of Jesus was this, Jesus was that. We don't have to get frustrated. Why? Because history is on the side of the first century person of Jesus. So how do we interact? I want to enter a time of question and answer, but first let me give you three ways that I think we can, in a really practical sense, interact with people. I'm going to give you three real quickly here, sort of levels. And if you want to think about this as sort of, well, I'm not real comfortable with it, start out with level one. If you're more comfortable, go to level two. If you're more energetic, go to level three. Level one, talk to your friends. Just talk to your friends over the water cooler, on the phone. Go for a walk with your neighbor's dog, as that person I talked about earlier. Talk about this, because guess what? People are talking about it for the first time, as we said earlier. Ask questions. I mean, here are a couple of examples. What percentage of the book do you think is true? That's a great opener. Why don't you take a look at this book? It's a different perspective. See what you think, and I would love to talk with you later about it. You picked it up for $4 at Timberline Church on May 17th. Hint, hint. Buy it. And examine your attitude. How do you feel when someone brings up, man, I was so shocked when I found out Jesus is married? Do you feel frustrated? Do you feel like you're on the defense? If so, then probably we're not equipped enough. Because if we're equipped, we're going to respond with a real gentle attitude. And you know what you have? You have an opportunity to share your faith, the truth of your faith, not only personal experience. Number two, here's another way to do it. Throw a Da Vinci Code movie party. And then invite them back to your house to talk about it. Can you imagine? You've got a captive audience. How many people would pay for that who want to talk about Jesus? That's amazing. But if you say, hey, let's go see the movie, and then go back to my place, and I'll make some popcorn, and you know, we'll just talk about it. Because I've been reading a book and have some interesting information. And again, you're approaching it real gently. Ask questions like, which did you like movie, book, or which did you like better, book or movie? What part of the movie did you like more or less? What did you hear that changed your opinion about history? What did you hear that changed your opinion about Jesus? If you could ask God one question about the Da Vinci Code and you knew He would answer, what would it be? Those are great open-ended questions that's going to get people talking about it. Let me give you a third one. Invite people into a discussion group, a.k.a. small group. Get that DVD curriculum. And say, hey, I remember you talking to me about that book. You liked it. Memorized that I hadn't read it, and I've just sort of been looking into it a little bit. I got this really cool curriculum on it. It's a DVD that's actually on location on site. He's in Paris looking at a lot of the different of these locations, pieces of art and so forth, architecture. And then actually dialogues about some scholars who know some information about, you know, the Nag Hammadi documents and the Dead Sea Scrolls and all this sort of stuff. You know, you want to come over for 4 weeks and watch it? Maybe you don't need to say 4 weeks. Why don't you come over and watch it? I've just got one video. And then if they like it, go 2 weeks. Okay? Ask questions like, you know, I know you like the movie. You know, would you want to join a discussion group? That's a great way to do it. Let me close with reading to you Colossians 4. This is it, you guys. Please write this verse down. Go home and put it up on your refrigerator. This is it. Colossians 4, 5 and 6. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. Wow. Isn't that beautiful? That's our charge. That's our commission. That's what we're called to do.